Department of Public Health, Brady, and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WBALLP Athol, WDJ. Framingham.
It is time now to begin the reading of today's Boston Globe for Thursday, the 26th of February, 2026. With today's Boston Globe, we say hello to Mary.
Hello, John, and welcome all listeners on this sunny day. Our Boston Globe on the front page has inspiration and a touch of reality. A Milford teen leaves speech after he's mentioned in tweet from DHS. By Marcella Rodriguez of the Globe staff. Washington, from the visitor's gallery, Marcelo Gomes da Silva looked down at the House floor, attentively watching President Donald Trump deliver his State of the Union speech. A guest of Representative Seth Moulton, the 19-year-old from Milford, was overjoyed to be sharing a room with the nation's most powerful politicians. I truly hope that one day I'll be here and I'll be a representative and then hopefully a senator as well. That's the dream, he said. Wearing a light gray suit, Gomes looked worlds apart from the day he met Seth Moulton for the first time last June outside of the ICE holding facility in Burlington, where he had spent 6 days detained in volleyball shorts and Crocs. This week in Washington, for the first time, he met with other members of Congress and talked about his experience in detention and his desire to end ICE operations that target people who, like him, do not have a criminal record. As he watched the speech, the teen looked for Moulton on the House floor, but he couldn't find him among a sea of politicians. He was impressed by... Impressed by Representative Al Green's protest of racist video posted on Trump's social media account recently, portraying the Obamas as apes. He didn't agree with President Trump's statement about how low inflation is and he felt dehumanized being called an illegal alien. Still, he planned to stay and listen to the entire address. Soon after standing up to applaud the U.S. men's hockey team, which President Trump honored during the speech, Gomes was escorted out of the chamber by Moulton's chief of staff, Nisha Suarez. Suarez and other congressional staff had seen an online post by the Department of Homeland Security calling out Democrats who brought immigrants as guests to the State of the Union, singling out Moulton and Gomes by name. Today, some Democrats in Congress are planning to bring illegal aliens as guests to the State of the Union. Once again, they are putting illegal aliens above the safety of American citizens. Officials wrote, Gomes is an illegal alien who has no right to be in our nation. We are committed to enforcing the law and fighting for arrest, detention, and removal of aliens like him. The Department of Homeland Security officials, who also named two other guests invited by Senator Chuck Schumer of New York and Senator John Hickenlooper of Colorado. excuse me. Nisha Suarez, who drove Gomes to Washington, was concerned about the heavy law enforcement presence while the teen was alone in the House gallery without his phone. Gomes watched the rest of the speech in Moulton's office. I cannot believe they still want to chase after me, Gomes said. I'm just disappointed in the ignorance. It's really inhumane and there's a lack of empathy. Originally from Brazil, Gomes first arrived in Milford, Massachusetts when he was 6 years old, along with his parents. He entered the United States legally with a visa that later expired. After his detention, he applied for asylum. His exit from the State of the Union less than halfway through President Trump's address reminded him of his vulnerability status in the country. Things are going so good, and then all of a sudden, you remember that you could get taken at any time, Gomes said. I truly believe that everything in my life is in God's hands. If he wants me to be here and work for the people and help immigrants as much as I can, I'll be here. But if he doesn't, then I'll go back. Despite the disappointment, Gomes was calm. He called his mother, texted friends, and checked social media. When he met Seth Moulton, Gomes back in his office, Seth Moulton told Gomes to keep fighting and invoked John Lewis's late representative and civil rights activist from Georgia by saying Gomes was making good trouble. We're obviously concerned about it, but sometimes in America you have to be brave and do brave things, Seth Moulton told the Globe. Sometimes when you really believe in freedom, you actually have to risk it. Sometimes you have to fight hardest for your country when your country lets you down. Seth Moulton, along with Representative Jake Auchinloss, greeted Gomes when he was released in June from the ICE facility in Burlington. About a week before, as a high school junior, Gomes was driving to the volleyball practice when he was stopped and detained. Hundreds of Milford, Massachusetts protested his arrest, carrying signs demanding the agency target criminals instead of students who took honor classes, participated in variety sports, and played the drums in his church band. ICE officials at the time said that they were looking for Gomes's father, alleging a history of speeding through residential neighborhoods reaching 100 miles per hour. Records show his father ran a stop sign once in 2023. Flooded by reporters following his release in early June, Gomes was clear about his new purpose. He would do everything in his power to support immigrants unfairly detained by ICE. Prior to detention, he wanted to pursue a career as a plumber. Now he's headed to college in the fall and plans to pursue a career in public service. During his 2 days walking around the Capitol in Washington, D.C., Gomes met with various Massachusetts politicians, including a private meeting with Senator Elizabeth Warren and a quick hallway chat with Senator Ed Markey and a brief introduction to Representative Jim McGovern. At Warren's office, Gomes saw a map of Massachusetts where constituents use pins to mark where they are from. "Oh my God, I'm the only one from Milford," Gomes said. Representative Gabe M.O. of Rhode Island told the teen he looked like a congressman and gave Gomes his phone number and said, "God bless you," Gomes said as he walked out of the office. "I'm so eager to start my career," Gomes said. "I love running around everywhere." Walking around the Capitol with Seth Moulton, Gomes met Representative Troy Neals of Texas, who was smoking a cigar and wearing a tie bearing President Trump's face. The tie made Gomes apprehensive. When Seth Moulton asked Gomes to tell Neals his story, the teen was scared the Republican would tell him he should be deported. Far from it. Neals welcomed him to Washington, D.C. Between meetings, politicians, and giving media interviews Tuesday afternoon, Gomes received a message from an ICE officer through the phone application he uses to check in with his agency under its supervision program. "My ICE officer doesn't believe I'm here. I need to send them a photo of the invitation," he said. Regarding reading a message from the application BI SmartLink, used by ICE to track people previously detained. They can search up on Google where I am," Gomes said. The message didn't faze him. His lawyer would be in touch with ICE, he said. Under the Capitol Rotunda during the tour Monday, Gomes took in the statues and busts of historical figures, including Martin Luther King Jr. "He stood up for oppressed people, and he had Christian morals," the teen said. While listening to President Trump during the State of the Union address, the man sitting next to Gomes supported the president. He heard Gomes telling his story to other guests and asked, "You don't blame Donald Trump for that, do you? It's not his fault. He would never want a kid like you to be taken by ICE," Gomes recalled. "To be honest, I actually do blame him," he replied. If he could, Gomes said he would want to have a conversation with President Trump. He'd tell him that family separation policies do not align with Christian values. "I'm disappointed about having to leave," he told Immigration Attorney Robin Nice on the speakerphone after the State of the Union. "It's just a reminder that I can get taken at any given time. Also on our front page is tariff ruling punches hole in Trump's calculations. Revenue was supposed to help cover costs of GOP tax cut legislations by Jim Pusorgena of the Globe staff. Washington. With the Supreme Court invalidating most of President Trump's tariffs, he and congressional Republican leaders now have major math problems. Hundreds of billions of dollars in government revenue they were counting on is now in doubt. The money was supposed to help offset the cost of their sweeping tax cut legislation enacted last year. Without that revenue, the federal government's budget deficit, already at alarming levels, could balloon even larger. Exacerbating the problem is the potential for refunds of the $175 billion in illegal tariffs that were collected from the U.S. importers since President Trump put them in place last year. They were going to bring in significant amounts of revenue, and this throws a wrench into that, said Mayor McGinnis, president of the Committee for the Responsible Federal Budget, a nonpartisan fiscal watch group. Her organization estimates that the Supreme Court's ruling against the high tariffs President Trump levied using the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act will reduce incoming federal revenue by $1.9 trillion through 2036 if the money is refunded and another source of revenue is not identified. That's a huge loss given the Congressional Budget Office projects that the Republicans' One Big Beautiful Bill, which combines new and extended tax cuts with Medicaid and other spending cuts, will increase the deficit by a total of $4.1 trillion from 2025 to 2034. The CBO did not count the income from the tariffs in its projections. It calls into question the wisdom of President Trump and the congressional Republican leaders banking on a gusher of money from the emergency tariffs that Democrats and many legal experts warned could be tossed out by the Supreme Court. They were counting on that revenue, said Representative Richard Neal of Springfield, Massachusetts, the top Democrat on the House Ways and Means Committee, which handles trade and tariff legislation. So I think that's really problematic. The numbers never added up, and now they're further complicated. President Trump has said that he will replace the emergency tariffs, which were as high as 50% on some U.S. trading partners, with a new global tariff of 15% on imports using different law. But that authority only allows the tariffs to be placed in place for 150 days unless they are approved by Congress, and his use of that law also is legally questionable. And it is unlikely tariff legislation could get through the House and the Senate. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent predicted the administration will be able to enact enough new tariffs using other laws so that there will be no drop in revenue from this year. Scott Bessent said that it could take months for lower courts to resolve the funds issues after the Supreme Court did not address that matter. President Trump remains undeterred, vowing to continue using tariffs to pressure countries to lower their own trade barriers and to generate revenue. President Trump inaccurately claims tariffs are paid by foreign countries when they are paid by U.S. importers when the goods arrive here. I use these tariffs, took in hundreds of billions of dollars to make great deals for our country. Countries that were ripping us off for decades and are now paying us hundreds of billions of dollars, President Trump said Tuesday at his State of the Union address. And then, just 4 days ago, an unfortunate ruling from the United States Supreme Court, it just came down. He has often called the tariff is his favorite word, praising 19th century presidents like William McKinley, who made aggressive use of them. And President Trump asserted Tuesday he would be able to continue enacting high tariffs without any congressional action, allowing money to continue pouring into the Treasury. So, as time goes by, I believe the tariffs paid by foreign countries will, like in the past, substantially replace the modern-day system of income tax, taking a great financial burden off the people that I love, President Trump predicted in his address. But the economists say President Trump's tariffs, the highest in decades, have contributed to slower job growth and continued elevated inflation as businesses wrestle with higher costs caused by the levies and how much of that to pass on to customers. In addition, tariffs are a terrible way to raise a lot of revenue, said Douglas Holtz Eakin, president of the conservative-leaning American Action Forum think tank. They are highly distortive, they are regressive, they are expensive to comply with and tough to administer, and they invite graft, he said. So this is not something that should be used on a broad scale. Representative Chip Roy, a Texas Republican on the House Budget Committee, said he never banked on the tariff revenue to help fund ongoing government operations. I think that's almost like gravy. Use it to pay down the debt. Use it to help Americans, Roy said. One thing he thinks Americans need some help with is offsetting the cost of the tariffs, and Roy said that he'd like to see some new tax cuts to address that. But additional tax cuts would only exacerbate the deficit problem that is fueling an exploding national debt, which now is nearly $39 trillion. President Trump and the Republicans have made little progress so far in reducing the budget deficit. Even with increased tariff revenue of about $120 billion in the fiscal year that ended in September, the Congressional Budget Office found that the federal budget deficit President Trump vowed to slash was essentially the same as it was in 2024. Like many Democrats, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren wants to see President Trump's administration refund the money from invalidated tariffs and scale down the tax cuts. It never made any sense for the Republicans to count on that, keeping that money, but they did it because they were determined to pass through the tax breaks for billionaires and billionaire corporations and lie to the American people about how they were going to pay for it, Warren said. Now the tariff revenue has disappeared. It's time to roll back those tax cuts. That's not going to happen under President Trump and a Republican Congress. And the loss of the tariff money combined with the projected cost of tax cuts makes the nation's fiscal situation more dire, said McGinnis. Trump's tariffs were projected to be the biggest revenue raiser in more than a decade until the Supreme Court struck most of them down. Now, without most of the tariffs, an already terrible fiscal situation will even be worse. Moving on to the inside. Also, a couple of articles on the front page to the topic of Epstein's records. Key Epstein records missing relating to Trump. Woman accused both men of sexual assault by Mike Baker and Michael Gold of the New York Times. Washington. The vast trove of documents released by the Justice Department from its investigations into convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein failed to include some key materials related to a woman who made an accusation against President Trump, according to a review by the New York Times. The material, the FBI memos summarizing interviews the Bureau did in connection to claims made in 2019 by a woman who came forward after Epstein's arrest to say she had been sexually assaulted by both President Trump and the financier decades earlier when she was a minor. The existence of the memos was revealed in an index listing the investigative materials related to her account, which was publicly released. According to that index, the FBI conducted 4 interviews in connection with her claims and wrote summaries about each one. but only one of the summaries which described her accusations against Epstein was released by the Justice Department. The other three are missing. The public files also do not include the underlying interview notes, which include index also includes are part of the file. The Justice Department released similar interview notes in connection with the FBI interviews with other potential witnesses and victims. It is unclear why the materials are missing. The Justice Department said in a statement to the Times on Monday that the only materials that have been withheld were either privileged or duplicates. In the news statement Tuesday, the department also noted that the documents could have been withheld because of an ongoing federal investigation. Officials did not directly address why the memos related to the woman's claims were not released. The woman's description of being assaulted in the 1980s by President Trump is a number of uncorroborated accusations against well-known men, including the president, that are contained in the millions of documents released by the Justice Department. When the files were made public late last month, officials described the trove as including all materials sent by the public to the FBI. Some of the documents contained untrue and sensational claims against the President Trump and were submitted to the FBI right before the 2020 election. The department said in a statement at that time, calling such claims unfounded and false. President Trump has repeatedly denied wrongdoing in a statement Tuesday, a White House spokesperson, Abigail Jackson, said. Trump has been totally exonerated on anything relating to Epstein. A lawyer who previously represented the woman in a lawsuit against Epstein's estate declined to comment. The missing records deepen the questions about how the Justice Department has handled the release of the Epstein files, which was mandated by law signed by President Trump last year after bipartisan congressional pressure. Under the law, the Justice Department can redact material that could be used to identify Epstein's victims, depicted violence, or child sex abuse, or would hurt a continuing federal investigation. By law, expressly prohibited by federal officials from withholding or redacting materials on a basis of embarrassment, reputational harm, or political sensitivity to a public figure. Some lawmakers and survivors of the Epstein abuse have strongly condemned the department for how it handled redaction, noting details identifying some victims were left exposed and photographs of young women were included in the public release, while material related to the claims of abuse and other men have been heavily redacted. The woman who made the accusation about Trump came forward on July 2019, days after federal investigators arrested Epstein on sex trafficking charges, according to records in the public files of the tips the FBI received during that period. This person claimed that she had been repeatedly assaulted when she was a minor in the 1980s, according to the summary of the FBI interview on July 24, 2019. The FBI did three subsequent interviews to assess her account in August and October 2019 and made a summary of each interview according to the index of the records compiled by the case. But memos describing those in three interviews were not publicly released. The public files do not contain a 2025 description of her account as well as other accusations against prominent men contained in the documents in that memo. Federal officials wrote that the woman had said that Epstein introduced her to President Trump and that she claimed President Trump had assaulted her in a violent and lurid encounter. The documents say that the alleged incident would have occurred in the mid-1980s when she was 13 to 15 years old, but they do not include any assessment by the FBI about her credibility of her accusations. The Times examination of several of serial numbers on the individual pages in the file, public files, suggests that more than 50 pages of investigative materials related to her claim are not in the public available files. The missing materials reported earlier by the journalist Roger Sullenberger of Substack by NPR. Moving on to the world, we have become the hostages of a heroic image by Olha Dunik, a social psychologist in Kyiv. Ukraine wants West's aid, not its love. Many residents tire of being seen as resilient by Maria Baranikova of the New York Times. Kyiv, Russian attacks had left Ksenia Shtila with no water, heat, or reliable electricity during the brutal winter. So when the power briefly flickered back on one recent day in Kyiv, the Ukrainian capital, she took an electric clipper, stepped up to the mirror, and strand by strand shaved off her blonde hair. While her young daughter was not happy, Shtila, 37, would no longer have to worry about not being able to wash her hair. I had a problem, and I solved it, she said. But please don't call her resilient. For 4 years, people of Ukraine have been celebrated abroad for their perseverance in the face of hardship, the smaller country that bravely stood up to Vladimir Putin's Russia. President Vladimir Zelensky himself has called the Ukrainians unbreakable. Shtila and many others, however, say that they are fed up with both the hardship and the being called resilient in the face of it. I see myself as a weak little girl who just wants to cry but cannot. She is a cook in a fast food restaurant. Ukrainians have been posting on social media that they no longer want to be labeled unbreakable. They are not superhuman. They break like anybody else and everybody else, and when they experience the pain. They want the world to know and to offer compassion and help. If you present Ukrainians primarily by focusing on strength, people might think that they don't need support and that they are fine by themselves, said Jonas Knust, a social psychologist at the BI Norwegian Business School. They are not fine by themselves, but Ukrainians must project strength. If it appears to be losing or giving up, that could jeopardize support it needs to survive, the money and the weapons from the Western allies. We have become hostages of our own heroic image, said Olha Dunik, a social psychologist in Kyiv. Zelensky acknowledged the sentiment in a speech marking the war's fourth anniversary Tuesday. He praised Ukrainians for their resilience, but also that they are human, not made of steel. Many Ukrainians do see themselves as strong and inventive. The only unsolvable problem is when you are in the cemetery, said Alonia Solondorkos, 38, who with her husband Sirhili, 40, trains children in martial arts. But as she watches her son and daughter during training, she admitted that she did not want them to have the life that they have now. February has been a cruel month, with hundreds of thousands of Kyiv left without heat, as nightly lows reach about 10 degrees below zero Celsius or 14 degrees Fahrenheit. Ukrainians say Russia has spoiled the first beautiful snowy winter in years. Katerina Shapurina, 39, a drama teacher, said life was on pause. Her apartment has been cold enough at night for water to start to freeze. She is fighting mold climbing her walls, and her children keep getting sick. She is divorced from their father of her first daughter, but cannot live with the father of her second daughter either. Both are in the army. Everything is on me, she said. This is sad and crazy. I do not feel strong enough to live through it. When a Russian missile hit the power plant across from Lydia Mila's Dubinichenko's home, causing a large fire, she ran outside. She was scared. Dubachenko, 62, told the neighbors a different story, joking that she was just trying to warm up next to the fire. a neighbor, Andriy Olbavinsky, 39, heard his 10-year-old son screaming after the missile strike. He ran into his room and saw the boy on bed covered with glass and Lego bricks. He and others said that they could not afford to be weak. My brother is sleeping in a trench at minus 20. You want me to complain? What did he make of all of this? I feel anger, he said. Yuri Zamlini, who is from Western Ukraine, came to Kyiv this month to cook food for people over a fire. He had loaded meat and friends into a car. He saw nothing special in it. I just saw you're struggling here in Kyiv, so I came. Yara Tajanokov, 37, said her neighbor was wrapped old clothes around pipes in their building near the Dnieper River in Kyiv so that they would not freeze. She also saw nothing special in that. If any other country were attacked like us, its people, just like us, would unite and protect their homes. In a nursery, nannies fight the chill by filling plastic bottles with hot water and wrapping them in colorful towels around them to make them look like candy. Children hug the warm candies when they nap in frigid rooms. Most of the nannies have husbands at war. Their homes are cold. Of course, I'm tired, said one of them, Ina Kumachik, 39. I'm not a robot. She put the children to bed, giving them each a warm candy. Sometimes I want someone to hold me close, the way you would hold a little child. I do not want to be called strong. Hang on. All right. Still in the world section of the paper. Iran accuses President Trump of big lies ahead of the Geneva event. Diplomacy route also suggested for nuclear talks by John Gambrell of the Associated Press. Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Iran pushed back Wednesday against President Trump's pressure tactics ahead of the critical talks in Geneva over Tehran's nuclear program, alternating between calling remarks big lies and saying negotiations may yield an agreement through honorable diplomacy. The remarks by two Iranian officials came a day before the talks, and the United States has assembled its biggest deployment of aircraft and warships to the Middle East in decades. The buildup is part of President Trump's efforts to get a deal to constrain Iran's nuclear program while the country struggles at home with growing dissent following a nationwide protest last month. President Trump has repeatedly threatened to attack Iran if negotiations fail. Mideast nations fear an attack could spiral into a new regional war as the embers of the years-long Israeli-Hamas war still smolders. Already, Iran has said all the United States military bases in Mideast would be considered legitimate targets, putting at risk tens of thousands of American service members. Satellite photos shot Tuesday by Planet Labs PBC and analyzed by the Associated Press appear to show American vessels that typically are docked in Bahrain, the home of the United States Navy's Fifth Fleet, are all out at sea. The Fifth Fleet referred to the questions to the military central command, which declined to comment. Before Iran's attack on Qatar in June, the Fifth Fleet similarly scattered its ships at sea to protect against a potential attack. President Trump touched on Iran in nuclear negotiations in his State of the Union speech late Tuesday in Washington, D.C. They've already developed missiles that can threaten Europe and our bases overseas, and that they're working to build missiles that will soon reach the United States of America, President Trump said. They were warned to make no future attempts to rebuild their weapons program, and in particular nuclear weapons, yet they continue. They are starting it all over. Satellite photos analyzed earlier by the AP show Iran beginning to rebuild missile production sites and doing some work on the three nuclear sites attacked by the United States in June. of 2025. Iran has long maintained that nuclear program is peaceful. The West and the International Atomic Energy Agency say Iran had a nuclear weapon program until 2003. Before the June attack, it had been enriching uranium up to 60% purity, a short technical step away from weapons grade level of 90%. Responding to President Trump, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Ismail Bahaghi sought to compare him to Joseph Goebbels, Adolf Hitler's propaganda minister. He accused President Trump and his administration of conducting disinformation and misinformation campaign against Iran. Whatever they're alleging in regards to Iran's nuclear program, Iran's ballistic missiles, and the number of casualties during the January's unrest is simply the repetition of big lies, Bagel wrote on X, formerly known as Twitter. President Trump said in his speech that at least 32,000 people were killed in last month's protests, which is at the far end of the estimates offered by activists for the death toll. The United States-based human rights activist news agency has so far counted more than 7,000 dead and believes that the actual figure is far higher. Iran's government, which long has downplayed death tolls in other unrests, offers its only toll on January 21st, saying 3,117 people were killed. Mohammed Baghir Qualifa, Iran's parliament speaker, said separately that the United States could either try diplomacy or face Iran's wrath. If you choose the table of diplomacy, a diplomacy in which the dignity of the Iranian nation and mutual interests are respected, we will also be at that table. But if you decide to repeat past experiences through deception, lies, flawed analysis, and false information, and launch an attack in the midst of negotiations, you will undoubtedly taste the firm blow of the Iranian nation and the country's defense forces. Iran and the United States are to meet Thursday today for their third round of talks under the mediation of Oman, a long interlocker between Tehran and the West. A flight carrying Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi and his team arrived late Wednesday in Geneva, where they will meet with the American officials led by U.S. Mideast envoy Steve Witkoff. Vice President J.D. Vance said President Trump had been clear that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. That just would be the ultimate military objective if that's the route that he chooses, Vance told the news. He said that President Trump prefers settling the matter using diplomacy, but will unleash military against Iran if necessary. Most Americans understand that you cannot let the craziest and the worst regime in the world have nuclear weapons, said Vice President Vance. Asked whether removing Iran's supreme leader was also an aim, Vance said that President Trump would make that decision about how to ensure Iran does not have nuclear weapons. If the talks fail, uncertainty hangs over the timing of any possible attack. If the aim of the potential military action is to pressure Iran to make concessions in nuclear negotiations, it is not clear whether the limited strikes would work. If the goal is to remove Iran's leaders, that will likely commit the United States to a larger, longer military campaign. There has been no public sign of planning for what would come next, including the potential for chaos in Iran. And I have one more in this section. No different topic from the opinion page by Edith Witter. We are changing an ocean we have barely explored. She is the CEO and senior analyst of Ocean Research and Conservation and Association. My first adventure into the deep sea was in 1984 inside a deep diving suit called WASP. It wasn't an acronym. It looked like the insect, yellow-bodied and transparent, a bubble head and articulating arms ending in pincers. Built for an offshore oil work at depths up to 2,000 feet, the hard shell suit was being tested by scientists as a tool for exploring the ocean's midwater, the part of the ocean between the surface and the ocean floor, the largest and least explored habitat on Earth. I went down hoping to see marine bioluminescence and life that produces light. Despite having just completed a PhD on the subject, the only bioluminescence I had ever seen came from animals hauled up in nets. Cameras at the time were not sensitive enough to capture the phenomenon, so the only way to witness it was in person. Since most deep-sea animals brought up in trawls produce light, I expected to see it, but as I descended, so little of life was visible that I assumed that the light display would be sparse as well. I was wrong. When I turned off my suit's underwater headlights, I found myself in the center of the fireworks show. Tethered to the surface by a long cable, the suit moved gently with the waves above, stirring the water around me. Blue sparks flashed in every direction. Clouds of liquid light pulsed and faded. When I activated the thrusters of my wasp suit, brilliant vortexes of blue radiance erupted from the propellers. I couldn't see the creatures producing it. They were either too small or too transparent, but I knew they were there, creating light from the chemicals synthesized from the food they ate. In what appeared to be an empty ocean, there was an astonishing abundance of light and life. That moment changed how I understood our planet. It revealed not only the richness of unseen life, but how we humans truly know about it. Exploration and sharing of knowledge and how the world works have always been an essential to human survival. Early humans explored to find food, shelter, and safety. In modern times, exploration has driven discovery and innovation, expanding medicine, technology, and our understanding of life itself. The impulse to explore is deeply human, yet somehow we have made remarkable little effort to explore the largest living space on our own planet. The ocean remains largely unseen, not because it lacks importance, but because humans have failed to appreciate how extraordinary it is. We are caught in a paradox. We do not explore because we do not fully understand its value, and we do not understand its value because we have not explored it. Meanwhile, we are altering it at an unprecedented pace. In the past 60 years, human activity has changed the ocean more profoundly than it did in previous 200,000 years. Industrial fishing has stripped away large fish and whales. Bottom trawling has flattened complex ecosystems that took centuries to form. Plastics, pollutants, and excess nutrients now permeate marine systems. Most alarming of all, humans are changing the temperature and the chemistry of an immense volume of water, hundreds of millions of cubic miles that regulate the planet's climate and sustain life on land and sea. Historically, serious funding for ecosystem research has come only after ecosystems collapse, when the public demands that something be fixed. But restoration is nearly impossible without understanding how a system functioned when it was healthy. We have not even adequately explored the oceans, much less conducted long-term observations needed to deploy a meaningful operating manual for the planet's life support systems, let alone a repair manual. Instead, humanity behaves as if the complex machinery that sustains life can absorb endless pressure. We are not carefully adjusting the controls. We are jumping on them, assuming consequences will somehow be avoided. Increasingly, they are not. The priority now must be exploration, and not as a luxury, but as a necessity. The oceans make the Earth livable. Regulating climate, producing oxygen, and sustaining biodiversity, yet they remain largely unknown. The new age of exploration is needed, one focused not on distant worlds, but on understanding and protecting life here at home. Most people are drawn to the mystery of the unknown. What few realize is that much of our planet still holds those mysteries. The ocean depths contain extraordinary forms of life, untapped chemical diversity with potential medical applications, and insights into biological processes we have yet to imagine. Exploration has always shaped humanity's future. Today, it may determine whether we have one worth inheriting. Moving on to the Metro section. Gracious Neighbors Led Us to Safety by Jessica Bartlett, Globe staff. Duxbury, the power gave its last shuddering gasp at 9 a.m. as the blizzard picked up on Monday, and I realized then that we were probably in trouble. This is from the reporter's notebook. Maybe I just hadn't paid enough attention to the warnings. It was the U.S. gold medals hockey game the day beforehand, and we had a long day of festivities. By the time I checked the snowfall predictions Sunday night, the situation had escalated from an eyebrow-raising 12 to 18 inches to an eye-popping 30-plus. But it was too late to do anything about it. We had food and a bunch of battery-powered chargers. We could make it a day without power. Worst case, we would leave and stay somewhere else. What stupid optimism. I hadn't considered we might be trapped even longer and without heat. And both of these things dawned on me as the lights and electronics whirred off early into the storm. My 8-year-old daughter was still playing happily on her iPad despite the power loss. Can I have Wi-Fi? She asked. I made my phone a mobile hotspot. I was wondering how long the heat would last. Our wood fireplace was in need of repair, and it wasn't safe to use, so we had no generator. The house was warm enough to last us through the day. At least there was that. My husband came in from shoveling feet of snow off the driveway, panting. At nearly 7 months pregnant, I was no help in that regard. I heard 3 transformers blow like gunshots, he said, and there was a tree falling across the road. Missed a fence, though. Small miracles. The buzzes of generators from some of the neighbors began to rumble in the background. I kicked myself for not having one, too. Or a snowblower. I added them to the never-ending tally of future home investments. By the afternoon, I realized the house was growing colder, and has anyone seen the snowplow come through? My neighbor texted at 1:46. No one had. The level of danger seemed to be escalating, and the towns requested National Guard. The governor issued travel bans. Cars were getting stuck. Some people texted that family members of carbon dioxide alarms had gone off. The family turned off that generator and called the fire department. Fire departments couldn't get to them, and they opened the windows. I called my parents, who also live in Duxbury, about 10 minutes away. They luckily still had power, and we made plans to go there as soon as the snowplow came. But if you can't get here, my mom said, what worst case scenario, maybe we can ask to stay with a neighbor, I said. Eversource sent an alert warning restoration would take days, dialing 211 for warming shelter information. I laughed. How would we even get to a warming shelter? The internet tied to a cell service soon went down. No texts, no emails, though I still could make phone calls. My mom called again. The thermometer in our bay window read 60 degrees. She wanted me to call the police. They can't even respond to actual emergencies right now. We just have to hunker down and figure it out tomorrow. In the candlelight, my husband and I bundled up our daughter in the warmest sweaters and socks and tucked her under 4 blankets. The next morning, the house was in the 50s, and the sky a clear, optimistic blue I could finally see outside the windows. The roads still hadn't been plowed. On the phone, my mom was more worried than before. You're pregnant. You have a child. You cannot live without heat for this long. I'm calling the police. So Sorry, it's kind of blurry here. She called me back within minutes with an update. Though the officers were kind on the phone, they were ultimately handcuffed. We could boil water on the stove to raise the temperature, except we have an electric stove, and we could walk to the main road and have somebody pick us up. But who would come and get us? And there we go. I proposed burning some paper grocery bags to generate some small amount of heat. My husband reminded me that our fireplace issues and asked what we would do if the house caught fire. At least then we wouldn't be here in the cold. He didn't laugh. We considered what other resources we had and how to ration them. If we shoveled out the grill, maybe we could heat water. We could still sit in the warm car in the driveway. We could ask to stay with a neighbor. My husband's sister, who also lives in town, called with an update. They got their generator working and had heat. In the absence of a plow, her husband had taken his snowblower to the entire street. If we could walk to the main road, he would come and get us. The house was 50 degrees. We packed bags like we were excavating a sinking ship, taking only what we could carry. I dug through the old winter coats. My daughter had found a puffer vest that might fit the dog. He was none too happy. My daughter happily donned her snow gear as if she were going out to play. "Are you sure you can do this? The snow was practically up to my waist in spots," he said. "We do not have a choice," I said. At the top of the driveway, we saw what our neighbors had apparently coordinated that afternoon. Three of them, all with snowblowers, were clearing our entire street. One also had a chainsaw and planned to take down the tree blocking the road as well. We thanked them profusely as we walked in the narrow path they had just begun to make and over to a street where the snow had been packed down by aggressive cars. My brother-in-law met us partway. Entering his warm home, my body finally relaxed. By noon Wednesday, the neighbors were cheering. Power had been restored. Many streets were still unplowed, though dozens in our town still lacked electricity. But in the absence of government, neighbors rallied, and the elderly neighbor at the end of the street, untouched side of the street, was trying to have a caregiver stop by. "Might have to get the snow blower gang back together," someone texted, and one after another, they agreed to help. And I'm sure this story represents a lot of what is going on outside today. Hopefully it's cleaning up wherever you are. And in some sports, we have still talking a little about Bruins. Swayman return with gold for the lament call. Jeremy Swayman's latest round of adulation came from his Bruins teammates just hours after touching down in Boston. Jeremy Swayman stepped on to the ice at Warra Arena in time Wednesday for Wednesday's practice. The goalie was met with fist bumps, hugs, stick taps, and a spot in the center of the stretched circle. While acknowledging he was looking forward to getting back into the building, Swayman said helping Team USA win the gold medal in Milan was an incredible experience. "Following the win, Team USA was diverted to Miami because of the blizzard." It started to sink in now, said Swayman. The reaction that we had gotten from people in the United States the second we landed down, and just outreach of family, a childhood dream come true, and the group that we did it with, especially the way we did it, is an unbelievable feeling and an incredible feeling that we will cherish forever. And again, the experience that I took from it was staying focused as you possibly can and being a professional in everything you do and performing on the ice at the biggest stage. He also pointed out that the men and women's teams spent a lot of time together in the village. "Seeing them in dining halls and sharing victories together is something that we will cherish forever," Swayman said. Also in the tip of the hat to several of his Team USA mates, including fellow goalie Connor Hellebusek, whose superb performance Sunday helped seal the gold rush. "Incredible. He's the reason why we're here. He's the reason why we're champions. And again, it's so special to share that bond with him and three goalies that we've had there, added Jeremy Swayman, noting that Jake Ockenger was the third. It's really, really a treat to share these moments with people like that. And obviously, the way he played, it spoke for himself. So incredibly grateful as he stepped up for us. It was a full embrace. It was a full embrace, man. And then McAvoy, an alternative captain on both squads, was forced to miss out most of the later stages of the last year's four-nation face-off with separated shoulder. McAvoy is expected to skate with the Bruins Thursday morning practice. The game status for Swayman and McAvoy for that night's game against the Blue Jackets is undecided. The man is the most deserving on the team that adversity he has been through and just refused to back down. He was a great leader for us. Obviously, his play spoke for himself. It was tears coming down. I'm just so proud of him and his accomplishments and the way he handled himself and obviously got that win. It was a huge factor for us. So I get to see it firsthand more than most guys on the team. What he does every day for this team, for his family, for this community. And again, I couldn't be more excited to share this medal with him forever. And moving on to the other article in the sports today was, it struck me, was by Sarah Sullivan, U.S. Women Hockey Gold is no laughing matter. The issue isn't with the president getting on the phone to congratulate an Olympic gold medal winning team. America's men hockey players deserve every syllable of celebration a proud and grateful nation has to give them. The issue is with the president who got on the phone to congratulate only one of our two nations gold medal winning hockey teams, and then using part of that telephone call to casually dismiss Team USA's woman who also won gold in Milan with an overtime goal against Canada. Moving on to more of that article here. Yet what U.S. women have done is statistically more impressive. Consider what women's hockey was only added to the Winter Olympics slate in 1998. Team USA with three gold medals was already from the outset standing along Canada as immediate hockey heavyweights. The United States has never failed to medal at the Olympics. In sports that we do, keep score over Italy. Team USA men's and women's hockey did equal damage to the scorecard, undefeated along the way to their equally dramatic and hard-fought win twin goals. But when it came to celebrations back home, that equality got lost. Complain all you want that I'm being overly sensitive, says Tara Sullivan. That's your right. Rant all you desire if you feel that the men's gold medal performance is being unfairly overshadowed, but that's not my fault. I'm sorry. It's not my fault. Where did that go? Blame the locker room celebration seen around the world and laughing and the laughter of whose echoes won't go away. When the president called, part of the conversation was an open invitation from President Trump for the team to visit the White House, specifically to attend Tuesday night's State of the Union address, and it came with a condition, however. I must tell you, we're going to have to bring the women's team. You know that, the president said. He was laughing, and as he was, players could be heard laughing too. It continued as President Trump joked he'd probably be impeached if he did not include the women's team. To him, those women were a punchline. To me, they are American heroes. Now more than ever, women politely declined the chance to be an afterthought at someone else's party. Officially, spokesperson for the team said it couldn't accept due to the timing and previously scheduled academic and professional commitments following the games. The statement made sure to insist, "We are sincerely grateful for the invitation we extended to our gold medal winning U.S. women's hockey team and deeply appreciate the recognition of their extraordinary achievements." Okay. We still have time. Making it work, how some workers on snow days were not an option on Tuesday. And here's how they made it to the office, by Dana Gerber of the Globe Staff.